From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the road funding gulf between downstate and rural Michigan.
There's no differentiation between a two-lane country road and a five-lane, six-lane artery, like 11 mile, 10 mile.
What does it say when most of America's statues are of generals, presidents, war heroes, but scarcely any real-life women?
You're telling half of our population, you're telling girls and women that, in fact, they have no real role in public life.
And the month of Ramadan fasting begins.
I think the funny thing is people think because Ramadan is about fasting that, you know, oh my gosh, you must starve during the month. But quite the opposite. Many people, including myself, gain weight during Ramadan.
Those stories and much, much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, you know it. Michigan's roads are sprouting potholes like spring tulips. And that bumping and banging you feel as you drive isn't going to improve anytime soon. In fact, a just released report finds it could take 12 years to see appreciable improvement in our roads. Meantime, Crane's Detroit Business has done an analysis comparing Michigan's current seven-decade-old road funding formula to Governor Whitmer's proposed changes, and it shows the gulf will widen between downstate and up north counties, even as more money is dedicated to the more heavily traveled roads in southeast Michigan. Chad Livengood of Crane's is here with us via Skype to talk about his story. Chad, how did you break this down?
So what I did was it took the existing pot of money through the formula known as Act 51. This is a formula that was originally devised back in 1951 during Harry Truman's presidency. It's been amended many times over the years, but it's the basis of how local county road commissions and cities and villages get money. I took all the money in each county that they get from the cities, the counties, and the villages and added it together. And then I just simply divided it by the number of registered commercial and passenger vehicles in each county to try to get a per vehicle number to kind of understand. We think about school funding. We've had this debate for a quarter century now about school funding on a per pupil basis. And there's been a concerted effort to try to narrow the disparity between well-funded school districts and underfunded school districts. And I wanted to look at it from that perspective for counties. And what I found was on the high end, Keweenaw County at the tip of the Upper Peninsula, least populated county in the state, 76% of the roads are in good or fair condition. They get $773 per registered vehicle. In Livingston County, they're at the bottom of the barrel, second to last in the state, one of the most fast-growing populated areas of the state. Half the roads are in poor condition. They get $123 per registered vehicle.
You know, you mentioned in your report, Metro Detroit politicians have long contended that the big three, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, are essentially donor counties carrying other parts of the state. Are they right when they make that complaint?
I set out to try to prove or disprove that. And what I found was we don't have any accounting as a state of where gasoline taxes are paid on a per county basis, because gasoline tax is actually paid by wholesalers, the distributors, the guys that bring your gas to the gas station. They pay the tax, then they hand it off to the retailer who builds it into your price. So there's no tracking on pump sales of gasoline in the state to be able to figure out where exactly all the gas tax is being paid. Brooks Patterson, Oakland County executive, and others for years have contended that Oakland County is a donor county. But what I did find out is you went to try to figure out where's the money go? How does it get distributed? At least on the local level. This analysis does not include state highways or any road that the Michigan Department of Transportation maintains. Simply trying to look at local funding. And so Macomb County right now, $136 per registered vehicle, $144 in Oakland, and in Wayne County, it's $194. In Washtenaw County, it's $153. So you can kind of tell how these numbers vary wildly across county borders.
Does Governor Whitmer's plan address some of this disparity?
Well, Governor Whitmer certainly puts a lot more money into a lot of urban areas and suburban areas with heavy traffic. But what I found was that the money does get dispersed pretty widely. And a lot of these up north rural counties are getting large increases. So Keweenaw County, they're going to go from $773 to $1,000. and $12. Marquette County goes from $225 to $269, but there are some sizable increases. Wayne County goes from $194 to $266. It kind of varies. I mean, the top percentage county that got the biggest percentage increase was Mackinac County, but the second largest percentage increase was Genesee County. So it seems fairly evenly distributed, but because of that, it doesn't really change the dynamic of where you have rural counties that get a lot more money per vehicle. And a lot of this is driven by the formula that rewards money to counties and cities and villages based on the number of center lane miles, the total miles of road. But there's no differentiation between a two-lane country road and a five-lane, six-lane artery, like 11-mile, 10-mile, the main roads that we all travel every day to get to work and home.
What were some of the legislators' reactions as you kind of presented this to them? I'm noticing State Senator Lucido used the Lord's name in vain.
Yes, I told him the numbers, and his response was, Jesus Almighty. He was floored by it. And part of it, he's thought this for a long time, that Macomb County was not getting its fair share. And he's had a proposal out there to basically decouple vehicle registration fees so that if you pay a vehicle registration fee in Macomb County, it stays there. I live in Macomb County, for example. I pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $350 per year for registration fees for two cars. And based on this breakdown, 136 of it is coming back for the local roads in Macomb County.
So as you talk to lawmakers, how might what you have found in this analysis affect the political trenches being dug over road funding by the governor and by lawmakers?
Yeah, well, this is just one aspect. I mean, this doesn't really solve the revenue problem, the shortfalls, but it is certainly an area that hasn't really gotten a lot of attention about how the money gets distributed. And for politicians, that is actually kind of important to try to figure out if they're going to go out and sell people on any kind of a tax increase, they have to go out and say, you know, have some kind of tangible proof. We're going to improve the roads in your neighborhood, your local city streets. And I think that's been lost a lot of the time in these debates that are kind of been driven by MDOT and state officials. There hasn't been a lot of emphasis looking at the condition and how to fix some of these crumbling roads, particularly subdivisions in the suburbs of Detroit and Grand Rapids and other older cities that have built out in the last couple of decades and really haven't made an accounting for how to replace that infrastructure.
And then, of course, we just had that released report from the Michigan Transportation Asset Management Council saying, hey, folks, we could see it take up to 12 years to see appreciable improvement in our roads. Chad Livengood, Cranes Detroit Business. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
The Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy indicates 1.4 million homes in our state are not hooked up to a sewer system. Many use septic tank systems, but there's a big problem. Molly Ripke is an aquatic biologist with the agency.
We estimate that about 24% of them are failing to the point that they could contaminate surface or groundwater. To go even farther, 5% of the homes in Michigan that should be relying on a septic system actually have an illicit discharge to surface waters of the state.
Yes, you heard that correctly. That means human waste is going into rivers and lakes. Lester Graham with the Environment Report finds government is not doing enough.
It's raining in Riverdale. This is a town of fewer than 120 homes, and it's about an hour north of Lansing. I'm following a couple of residents and a health department official as they walk around taking off manhole covers and looking inside. They're checking to see if the water is running clear in the pipes beneath the town. In some places, it is not clear.
I can smell it from here.
There you go. Roses.
Yeah, that looks pretty nasty.
You'll love the outlet then.
Bob Lombard has lived in Riverdale since he was a kid. He takes us down to a tributary of the Pine River. That outlet he talked about is a corrugated pipe spilling its contents into the creek. Liz Braddock is with the Mid-Michigan District Health Department, and she describes what we're looking at.
We have a pipe that has constant flow. It smells like sewage, and from what I'm looking at, there seems to be evidence of possibly some toilet paper coming into the stream.
Yeah, I think that's more than a little evidence.
Yeah. So there's some type of a connection, but there's an illicit discharge somewhere. And when people flush the toilet, it's connected to this drain that is discharging into the stream that goes into the Pine River?
We moved here in 1977. It's been like that ever since. A long time.
Why is it nobody actually said something about this?
We're more worried about the crap above ground than below ground.
So, yeah, small town, economically depressed area. They had other things to worry about. The state estimates there are thousands of places like Riverdale. Add to the human feces, the livestock manure spread on farm fields, and health officials think we're headed for a lot of trouble. Marcus Cheatham is the health officer with the Mid-Michigan District Health Department.
Research, we have human feces through DNA testing in our rivers and lakes, and that carries with it pathogens.
That's bad. People can get sick, really sick. But Cheatham says all those nutrients from human and livestock waste, they're setting a stage for another health worry, cyanobacteria, and its toxins could start killing people.
It's just a difficult problem when you have billions of dollars in underground infrastructure all over Michigan that's in jeopardy of failing, and we're seeing this rising tide of organic pollution, and will we be able to figure out a way to deal with it?
The state of Michigan does not inspect septic systems to see if they're working or if the house even has a system. A handful of counties do inspections when a house is sold, but if the septic system is failing at a house that doesn't sell for decades, it's polluting the entire time. Joan Rose at Michigan State University is an internationally recognized expert on these kinds of water issues. She says even when septic systems are working correctly, they're not good enough. There's no disinfection. Bacteria and viruses escape.
So anytime anybody gets sick, these organisms are going into our septic tanks. These are small enough to get through the soil in many cases, so they can reach groundwater. They could also reach surface water.
But even with shortcomings like that, a well-maintained septic system is better than nothing. Back in Riverdale, Bob Lombard and some of his neighbors are trying to get some state and federal help to stop human waste from going into the Pine River. Replacing a septic system can run as high as $40,000. The values of some houses here are not that much. The Mid-Michigan District Health Officer, Marcus Cheatham, says fixing this problem should be just as much of a priority as fixing Michigan's roads. But septic systems are underground, out of sight, out of mind. For the Environment Report, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
And coming up, Manistee Hospital will be closing its maternity ward at month's end. We'll talk about what this means for expectant women in the area and examine the lack of OB units across rural Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You may recall last week we all learned about Rad Women GR, a placemaking project where 27 women artists are painting prominent American women on mechanical boxes around downtown Grand Rapids. And that's pretty unique. Think about the public monuments and statues that you see in big cities, say New York or D.C. What do they show us? Generals on horseback, statesmen, heroes. And as a story in CityLab.com notes, virtually none are women. In both New York and Washington, in fact, the number of statues of real women with first and last names, you could count them on one hand. Let's talk more about the gender gap in public art and sculpture. Here with us now is Tina Olson, director of the University of Michigan Museum of Art. It's such a pleasure to have you with us, Tina.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
When I read this piece, it was from February 2016 in City Lab by Kristen Capps. I'll admit I was surprised to learn that New York and Washington are both so full of statues and public memorials that each had only five statues depicting historical women. Now, does that surprise you?
It does not surprise me, I'm sorry to say. And if you think about it, as you just brought up, who gets represented, the history of statuary and public art in this country, as in most countries, really has focused on victors and generals and presidents and political leaders. And those are all fields and all spheres of work from which women historically were excluded, legally excluded and culturally excluded. So it's not that surprising that there's not a lot of representation of women if that's the way that we define public art and statuary.
And when you think of the kinds of statues we're talking about, the big boom for those was really, what, late 19th, early 20th century?
That's right. 19th century and first half of the 20th century is where the bulk, the majority of public statuary of figures in this country comes from.
You know, and I have to wonder, how much does it matter in that I talked to some younger people and I said, I just kind of, without telling them why, I asked, you know, do you pay attention to statues? And the answer was no. It's just background noise. They don't look and I don't know that they're taking anything away from that. Does this matter?
I think it matters tremendously. I think that people feel that way because so much of the built environment, the environment we make, buildings and statues and currency and stamps, we tend to disregard, or it becomes so part of us and part of our environment that we don't see it anymore. And yet, to a very great degree, that environment speaks. It tells us what's important. It tells us who's important. It tells us how history gets made and gets told.
Very good point. And it certainly we know the city of San Francisco was aware of their problem and last year passed an ordinance saying at least 30% of historical figures depicted on statues and other artworks on public owned land be of women. And the ordinance had some interesting language as it talked of, and I'll quote the ordinance, a silent message of women's insignificance. What is the overall effect of this dearth of real women in our public art, our public memorials?
I think that the dearth of any group, in this case half of the population, in our memorials, in our physical landscape, tells a story about who matters and how history is made. And so if you only have not just men, but also certain kinds of agents, certain kinds of actors, what you take away from that is that those are the people that matter, and those are the people that affect change and affect history. And in this case, you're telling half of our population, you're telling girls and women that, in fact, they have no real role in public life. That's critically important in terms of how we're teaching and how we're conveying to girls, to young women, what their lives are about or how they might affect change.
How much of all of what we're talking about is also due to the fact that there aren't a lot of women artists who are creating this work? Am I right there?
You are certainly right there. From the 1970s onward, that began to change with women having a larger and larger role in public art as artists. But as with these other fields that we're describing, through the most of the history of art, women were excluded from the institutions or the academies or the schools from which they would train as artists and then be credentialed as artists. It's not that different from where we began. If you're not allowed to be within a sphere of activity, then you're not going to be represented within it.
So let's talk about how this gets corrected. Is that San Francisco ordinance a good place to start?
So that's a great place to start. That's a really exciting and, you know, model kind of program. There are others afoot as well. You mentioned New York. There's an organization called She Built New York City that is explicitly working to address the gender gap there in the city's monuments. So they've just announced plans for a statue of Elizabeth Stanton and Susan B. Anthony that'll be erected in 2020, which is the 100th year anniversary of the 19th Amendment. So there are efforts afoot in a number of cities to really address this gender gap.
There's an acknowledgement.
Yes, absolutely.
What about other modern day options? We don't seem to be erecting statues the way we were in the early part of the 20th century. What other options might exist to give women a place in public spaces? For example, I'm thinking of, would a park do the same, named after someone?
I think absolutely. And I know, and there are also efforts in the National Park Service and elsewhere across the country to think about not just statuary, because if you think about it, statuary is kind of an old form of public art, and a lot of public art doesn't look that way anymore. And so efforts to tell that story and acknowledge women's histories can happen in the form of museums, can happen in the form of parks, can happen on stamps, can happen in currency. There's a whole range of ways can happen in Wikipedia. I mean, all of the efforts to try to even out where women show up in terms of our sources for history, there's lots of energy afoot.
Why is it that when you do think of women in statues, in public art memorialized, it's the ideal. It's Lady Liberty. It's, you know, virtue. And it's just some female form that is the embodiment of some aspirational feeling.
There's a long history in statuary and in public art in which women represented ideas and ideals. And so they were allegories of virtue. They were the Statue of Liberty. They were goodness and grace, the three graces.
Justice. Blindfolded
and
justice.
Exactly. Yeah. But they were not real women. They were not people who had names. They were embodiments of ideas, whereas men were real men with real names. And if you just think about that in terms of what you're modeling and who gets to see themselves, it's very hard to project yourself into the Statue of Liberty. It's very different to do so around Abraham Lincoln.
I'm curious, too, if public art, say a statue, a plaque on the side of a building that describes someone's life, does that have different meaning when it comes to representing women than, let's say, a painting in a museum might?
Well, if you think about it, public art is in our world. Public art is there when you're walking to work, when you're going home. It's in parks. It's in public spaces. It's very, very different. It has a very, very different kind of impact than a work of sculpture or a painting that's within an institution that you have to walk into and often pay admission to see. So it just signals and signifies in a much, much grander and larger way than an object or a work of art that's inside a building.
Tina Olson, director of the University of Michigan Museum of Art. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yet another Michigan hospital will soon shed itself of its obstetrics unit. Manistee Hospital closes its maternity ward on May 31st. Expectant moms there will be able to get care before and after giving birth, but for the birth itself, they'll need to drive to hospitals that are 40, even 60 minutes away. And it's a story getting more and more common, especially in rural Michigan. Amy Zagman is executive director of the Michigan Council for Maternity and Child Health. Good to have you with us, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
So according to the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, this was startling. In the 1980s, we had over 220 hospitals in Michigan. These days, that has dropped to 133, and of those, only 81 offer OB units. I want to dive into the why in a moment, but first let's talk about what this means for mom and baby. You've got, you know, mainly rural areas, a state where women in 36 of 83 counties have no hospital OB unit. Does that also tend to mean no OBGYN doctors as well?
It can, because of the nature of obstetrical care, really relies on the OB having privileges at the hospital to deliver the baby. Often you will see obstetricians, their offices are located in the same county or sometimes in the hospital. So certainly it is found that sometimes OBs will travel to other areas to have, you know, 1 day a week or 2 day a week office hours. But on the whole, they tend to be located in the counties where there are hospitals that offer labor and delivery.
Okay, so no labor and delivery units, and then very few OBGYN doctors in these counties for these women. When you think of the distances that women from these rural areas are traveling, big distances when it's time to give birth. I know when that OB unit in Manistee closes at the end of the month, those women are going to have to go 40 minutes away to Ludington or even 60 minutes away to Cadillac. How does that affect the health of both the mother and the newborn?
Certainly, we know that if someone has to travel, there could be a number of things that might make the trip even longer, whether accident or construction. And so you start to get into longer time periods when we know that a woman can be with the type of provider that can attend to her birth in the best way possible. And so that's very concerning. And we want families to have plans with their providers, but sometimes plans are just that. And babies come when they're ready. And there can certainly be emergency circumstances as well that may make a 40-minute or 60-minute drive very dangerous for both mother and infant.
As we see these OB units closing around Michigan, are we seeing a reflection of that in maternal and infant death rates in our state?
So because the numbers are so small, that's, you know, part of what's driving these closures is the low birth rate. Mm-hmm. When we look at population health statistics and outcomes, often what we're looking at are trends over years and looking at numbers where there are a significant number of adverse outcomes. We do have some of the highest infant maternal mortality rates in the state in some of the more rural areas that have been impacted the most by some of these closures in recent years.
And statistics don't matter one bit if you are a mother who has lost a baby because you're on a long drive to get to a unit. You don't care about statistics. That is a terrible tragedy in that family.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot more to be said about sort of what closing a labor and delivery unit says about the future of a community. And so while I think that understanding the economic pressures that hospitals have, we can understand the decision to close a labor and delivery unit, somewhat predictable with a lower birth rate and the aging of some parts of our state, it's very alarming, not only, like you said, for individuals, for families who may live in those communities, but just thinking about the long-term viability of a community. If you cannot attract families to a certain area because there's not certain quality of life or certain services available, including obstetrical care, including the ability to go to a hospital in a reasonable distance to deliver a baby, a new member of the family, this aging of some parts of our state, I don't know how you stop that spiral if we can't attract young families to live and have families in those areas.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the growing trend of hospitals in Michigan closing their obstetrics units. Talking with Amy Zagman, who's executive director of the Michigan Council for Maternity and Child Health. And you touched on a very core issue, Amy, about Michigan's birth rate. It's at a 76-year low. Certainly that means fewer OB patients. So I guess you have to ask, why wouldn't a rural hospital decide, you know what, we're going to have to close that expensive OB unit. It's just not financially sustainable. And also, if I'm an obstetrician, why would I not want to practice in an urban area where I have partners? I'm not the only one. Nobody wants to be on call 24/7.
It is very understandable, both for hospitals and practitioners, that the low birth rates and the widespread geography of some parts of the state do make it unsustainable for them to keep these services open. I think it's just very concerning for families who continue to live in those parts of the state and, as I said, continue to visit those parts of the state. It leads us to a conversation where I think we really need to reexamine labor and delivery services and obstetrical care in a way where we need to think about what is the base level of services that needs to be available wherever someone is located in the state, and what would it take to support and maintain those services so that we don't leave hospitals and providers in the situation of making what is a very understandable and rational decision, but it still shortchanges women and families who live in those areas.
Let's talk about answers to this problem. It seems that those might break down to encouraging hospitals to keep the OB units open and also finding creative ways to get obstetric care to women in rural areas. What solutions strike you as worth exploring?
So I think there's certainly a lot of work going on now with providers who are known as more sort of safety net providers, like our federally qualified health centers, who often are the obstetrical point of care for women prenatally, postnatally. For them to work to provide that care and also come up with the best plan possible when it comes time for delivery for a woman. So I think there's a lot of work going on to make sure that care is still being provided in communities across the state. I think that there needs to be a much more thoughtful conversation on the part of state legislators and the administration in the state about what can be done to support small rural hospitals or hospitals where the birth rate is very low in our state to maintain those services. There is a funding pool available to small and rural hospitals in the state currently, but the adequacy of that certainly could be questioned as these closures continue to happen.
What about midwives, nurse practitioners? How could that be their help be used?
So I think certified nurse midwives and nurse practitioners are being used in many of the safety net settings as well as in hospital settings across the state. There has been more of a rise of home births attended many times by certified professional midwives who were recently licensed in the state. I think you have to have some idea of the risk factors involved with each scenario and your own individual risk factors if you're a woman who's pregnant and considering your options. And it's very important that we make sure that people are not making decisions based solely on the availability of services in their area, but rather what's the safest for good outcomes for the woman and the child.
You know, as we talk about this, my mother grew up on a farm. She was born in 1922 at home, grew up on a farm in Ontario, and most of her brothers and sisters of that large family were born at home. Are we seeing things cycling back to the way they used to be in rural areas when home births were the norm and people made do because that's all you could do?
Well, certainly we've seen a rise in home births. Many of the reports are that folks in rural areas are more likely to avail themselves of those services. I don't know that many people are comfortable with the idea of the only medical care that's available to them is at a 1922 standard.
Right. It's not a good thing that we're talking about 1922 standards. Nobody's choosing this. What does it say to you about our health delivery system in 2019 for these expectant moms and their newborns if we're thinking about 1922 levels?
Yeah, I think we would absolutely agree with you that, you know, while I don't want to impinge on anyone's choices,
right,
the idea that that be forced on someone is certainly not something that we would agree with. So we really need to be thinking more thoughtfully about how we're going to build an entire system that really recognizes everyone in the state, regardless of where they live.
Amy Zagman, Executive Director of the Michigan Council for Maternity and Child Health. Amy, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Still to come, Dearborn has a vibrant nightlife overnight during the holy month of Ramadan, when many Muslims will fast from sunup to sundown. We'll hear about all of that in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last year, two people were shot and killed in Michigan while deer hunting. One of those victims, Justin Beadle, was hunting on family property near Torch Lake. It was opening day, November 15th, when another hunter shot Beadle from about 50 yards away. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources investigated the case. Lieutenant Jim Gorno is a conservation officer.
We would classify it as an accident at this point.
And that's pretty much all the DNR would say about this shooting. But there was more to it, which became apparent when the shooter was charged with involuntary manslaughter and trespassing. Interlochen Public Radio's Morgan Springer has this story.
So right here starts my property with all these trees. I have 12 acres.
This is Teresa Sherman. She's the mother of Justin Beadle.
A garage right there.
We're driving along the road at the edge of the property where her son was killed. It's been in her family since the 1940s. Beadle was 38 when he was killed. He was married, lived in Sanford near Bay City, and was a Harley mechanic. He just opened up his own bike shop.
It was a genius with bikes.
Sherman says last fall, her son would ride his bike up north to the property most weekends to set up game cameras and bait for hunting season. On opening day, Beadle headed out early, and by around 9 a.m., he'd shot his deer.
He came over in the morning after he shot the deer. He said, I'm just going to let it lie there for a minute, so let's just run and get breakfast. We went to the Riviera, and we got back here, and he just looked at me, and he said, I'm just going to go gut the deer, and I'm going to come back here, sit in the hot tub, drink Busch Light. And that was the last I talked to him.
But nobody's talking about what happened next and how her son was shot and killed. Jim Rossiter is the Antrim County prosecuting attorney.
I have to be cautious about what I say because it is a pending case, but as of right now, these are simply allegations.
But the DNR's investigative report paints a pretty vivid picture. In the early afternoon, after Justin Beadle had eaten breakfast at the Torch Riviera, he found his deer dead on a ridge on the family property, and he began to gut it. Down the hill, a man named David Barber left his family property and crossed the street. The investigative report says he walked past the no trespassing signs and onto the property belonging to the victim's family. Teresa Sherman says the Barbers had been trespassing on their land for generations.
And for our generations of grandfather, father, us, have told them not to be on the property except with permission. I guess we just thought they would obey the rules. They had their own property across the street. We didn't understand.
Barber walked up a hill, and when he reached the ridge, he says he saw movement. He thought it was a deer. He lifted his rifle and fired. Then the report says he went to find the deer. But instead, he found Justin Beadle, who was gasping for air. After that, Barber, the shooter, says he tried to call 911, but his phone died. He went across the road and found a friend who had a phone, but Barber, who was 45 years old, decided to go get his mother first. About a minute later, Barber returned with his mother, but she had apparently forgotten her phone. So they end up using the friend's phone after all and finally call 911. The report says medics came and they officially pronounced Justin Beadle dead about an hour later.
Should I keep going?
Yeah.
Sherman and I turn right onto a dirt road in Alden and drive past the house of the shooter's mother.
His mother lives in that log house right there.
We drive about 15 yards up the road to where David Barber crossed the street.
He went in right in there.
Right here?
Yeah, right here. Up on that ridge up there is where he shot from, and he shot Justin over down. He was looking down at another ridge.
The Antrim County prosecuting attorney charged David Barber with involuntary manslaughter for gross negligence. He's also charged with trespassing. Barber and his attorney never responded to requests for comment. I reached out to multiple members of his family, and they declined to talk on tape, but they say that Barber is having a hard time. His brother said, quote, "It's a tragic accident. That's what it boils down to. It's a tragedy on both sides. My deepest sympathies go out to the family," end quote. Lieutenant Jim Gorno, the conservation officer for the DNR, says hunting deaths are very rare in Michigan.
Hunting accidents have actually been going down in the last 10, 15 years.
Last year, there were 3 hunting accidents in Michigan, including beetle, which was more than usual. By contrast, 18 people died this past winter in snowmobiling accidents, according to the DNR.
This is a beautiful view.
Thanks. A lot better since the big storm four and a half years ago.
Really?
Sherman's house overlooks Torch Lake. The water is cold blue to match the cold day. On the kitchen table is a large photograph of her son, Beetle, smiling.
I did a picture of him.
I saw that.
And that's going to hang right there. So if you think anybody's ever going to forget him,
they're
not forgetting him. That is him, though. He's bigger than life.
Sherman says he was a happy, fun kid.
He'd strike out a baseball, and he'd turn around, and he'd be smiling. And I'm like, and he goes, still had fun.
At his funeral, she says they played a recording of her son's laugh and drank Busch Light. Sherman says when she's here in her Torch Lake house and on her family property, that's when she feels her son's presence the most.
And I think I still talk mostly in the present tense, and, you know, I don't know if I even want to ever switch. It just feels better to think of him. I still feel like he's sitting over there going, Jesus, stop it. You know, enough about me. You know.
Even though Sherman's happy to talk about her son, she's also a lawyer and she doesn't want to jeopardize the case.
Like, do you think about it as an accident? Like
how? No. But I don't want to get into too much because of the trial.
But for you, it's not. You don't just think this was a hunting accident.
No.
Sherman says justice for her son is a guilty verdict for David Barber. The case is set to go to trial in June. For Stateside, I'm Morgan Springer.
This is the first day of Ramadan, and for the next 4 weeks until June 4th, Muslims will observe their most sacred month by more prayer, more studying of the Quran, acts of charity, and by fasting every day from dawn to sunset. That fast during Ramadan is one of the 5 pillars of Islam, so people take it seriously, going through their days without eating or drinking anything. Ah, but once the sun goes down, the fun and the eating can begin. Zahir John Muhammad wrote a piece for Our Detroit magazine, taking us to Dearborn as it comes alive after hours during Ramadan. Zahir, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So for people who are not Muslim, tell us, what is a typical day like during Ramadan?
So generally, the fasting starts at sunrise. So people usually wake up around, I don't know what time sunrise is this year, maybe let's say 5, 5:30 or so. usually have a light meal, like a shake or something, something to hydrate you because you're also abstaining from water during the day. And then you begin your fast. There's some prayers that you recite. And then you begin your fast, and then you fast until sundown. And then at sundown, that's when the real sort of celebration begins. I think the funny thing is people think because Ramadan is about fasting that, you know, oh my gosh, you must starve during the month. But quite the opposite. Many, many people, including myself, gain weight during Ramadan because it is, you know, when you're fasting all day, as much as it's logical to have like a healthy shake at night, you know, or some juice, you really want something sort of guilty. You
well,
know?
Like you've earned it.
Like, yeah, shawarmas and french fries, something like that, you know, nachos, burgers. I mean, that's what I grew up wanting. And also you watch TV and you see a commercial about fried chicken and you want to eat that. So it really is a celebration. And I wanted to sort of highlight that in my piece. And I think Dearborn is such a unique place that has no other equal in America in terms of its Ramadan culture. There's nothing really like Dearborn in America.
And as you pointed out, it was more about home parties, but this is kind of evolving in Dearborn?
Yeah, so there's a massive population mostly in East Dearborn. So majority of people do their iftars at home. And that's partly because...
And iftar is?
Yeah, iftar is the breaking of the fast. Mm-hmm. So that's when the sun sets, you have the breaking of the fast. You usually begin with date, and then you have like a meal, and then there's prayers that you recite. But most people do it at home because long hours, you want to do your prayers with your family. But increasingly, Ramadan is becoming a very public activity. So you can go to a different mosque every night in Dearborn and eat for free. So all the mosques have free food. And it's open for everyone. Muslims predominantly go, but non-Muslims can come as well too. So if you didn't want to pay for dinner for 30 days in Dearborn, you could do that.
Wow.
I don't recommend it. I recommend you do. And people sign up early in advance. But then now they have these night festivals, which is what really sort of intrigued me. The idea that they have a festival that starts at midnight, and it goes until 5 a.m. And it's every Saturday and Sunday this year. Last year, they did one, and it was just was so massive. I think the police had to shut it down because of some fire code violations. So
so many people turned
out.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, it's majority Muslims, but you also have non-Muslims. You have tons of children there. You have games. And so it really is a festive mood. I mean, what a lot of people do, and I'm guilty of having done this when I was younger, is you eat all night, you watch movies, play ping pong, and then you sleep during the day. So you don't really experience a fast. And that's what I did when like Ramadan was like when I was like in middle school or stuff.
Sure.
Now that I'm older, I try to be an adult and stay awake during the day.
Try to embrace the process,
exactly.
If you will. So restaurants are open? Is it food trucks?
What's there? So what intrigued me was about 10 years ago in Dearborn, only maybe one or two restaurants had special programs for iftar. There's New Yasmin Bakery, which is one of the oldest Lebanese places, I think was the first to open 24 hours. Mm. But then other businesses decided, you know what? This makes sense. You know, people are coming. People want to come to our place at 3 in the morning, at midnight. And so most places extend their hours by a little bit, but there's a number of them, I'd say maybe about a half a dozen or so that are open 24 hours. A few decide they really want to focus on fasting, and so they shut down entirely. So there's Dearborn Meat Market, which has phenomenal kebabs, so they shut down the entire month. So some people do that as well, too, but more and more places have this sort of late-night culture, which is really what happens because you break your fast, you go to the mosque, you come out of the mosque after these long prayers at around 10 o'clock, and you're hungry.
Because I would imagine, thinking of the evening prayers, mm-hmm. there's a lot of motion. There's bending. There's lying prostrate. There's getting up and down. So if you've eaten too much after 15 hours, something tells me that would not be wonderful.
Exactly, yeah.
So you eat something light, and then you dive in after prayers.
Absolutely,
after
and it's
prayers.
Also a very social month. People are very generous. People will pick up tabs for others. I mean, it is a really, and I think that's probably one of the biggest misperceptions people have about Ramadan is that somehow like Muslims dread the month. But I know many people who are not religious throughout the year, but then when Ramadan comes, they may not pray five times a day, which Islam sort of mandates, but they will pick up Ramadan traditions. So, and that's sort of where I feel I fall in line. Like I'm not as religious as I used to be, but when Ramadan comes, I sort of kick in and get really excited about this month.
And I think as you explore even in your podcast, Racist Sandwich, I mean, this idea of food and what it means really is a social statement, bringing people together.
Absolutely. I think what I also wanted to focus in my article for Our Detroit was, unfortunately, just given climate in America, in some places in America, Muslims feel nervous. So I'm 42 years old. I mention my age because You know, when I was growing up, not many people really knew what a Muslim was. So we were really open, you know, playing basketball late at night during Ramadan. But I noticed that when I go back to Sacramento, California, where I was born and raised, you know, the Muslim kids have to be a little bit more careful now, just given, unfortunately, the rise in hate crimes. And just the numbers are like that. I see that in small towns in America, you can't really have big public events. Mosques look different because, you know, there's, you know, hate crimes against mosques. But Dearborn, because of the density of residents in East Dearborn, you can go from midnight until 5 a.m., play basketball, eat whatever, and no one's really going to bother you. And the police have been really receptive, and they're helping sort of organize these, or, you know, provide safety for. So that's something that's unique. And so when I came to Michigan, and I would go to these functions in Dearborn, I was like, wow, this feels very different. I mean, the Ramadan is sort of the same everywhere, but in many ways it isn't. And I think in Dearborn, you do get a sense of like, oh, wow, like I can really feel at ease. And that's a really unique thing that every time I bring a Muslim American friend from another part in the U.S., and they're just like, wow, I wish we had this.
What are some of the best foods that someone would find?
Gosh.
Oh, start. Take us. Talk food to us.
So let's see. So the funny thing is that a lot of the young people, they now really like hamburgers, like to break their fast with hamburgers. And Dearborn, people always think about kebabs in Dearborn. Yeah. But I think actually Dearborn has phenomenal burgers. There's a place called Tasties for burgers. It's actually located in a gas station. That's terrific. There's Brahm, which is actually in West Dearborn. There's Zoe's Burgers. If you want traditional Middle Eastern food, my favorite place is Sheba, which is a Yemeni place, one of the oldest, I think, Yemeni restaurants in Metro Detroit. Sheba is phenomenal. That's where I take most of my friends. And then the traditional places, of course, Al Amir, which is Lebanese. And then there's a bakery called Shatila, which is open a little bit later.
What's the best thing to eat at Shatila?
At Shatila, they have this, the most popular thing in Ramadan is a phyllo dough with rose water. And so if you just ask for the rose water phyllo dough baklava, that's like their most popular thing. And then New Yasmin Bakery is really good. There's more and more Yemenis moving to Dearborn because of, you know, what's happening in Yemen. And so you have these new Yemeni places popping up. There's a coffee shop called Kahwa House, which is just Arabic for coffee. Kahwa means coffee. And that's great. I just interviewed the owner recently. He said, like, as soon as the sun sets, his place is packed. And that's a lovely thing that these new spaces have, you know, been created for the Yemeni community.
And just to kind of be real clear, is everyone welcome?
Everyone is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, again, another misperception that people have. You know, obviously, the majority of residents in Dearborn are Arab. There's a lot of Arab Christians there, but there's a lot of just non-Muslims. I mean, one of the coolest stories in Dearborn is a place called M Cantina, which is a Mexican family. They're not Muslim, but because they saw their clientele was mostly Muslim, their food is halal. They don't serve alcohol. And so, you know, I think when we think about like what is like Ramadan food, I mean, a lot of the young people I interviewed, they'll go to M Cantina to break their fast. Mm. So I think we sometimes tend to exotify Dearborn and say, oh, they're eating kebabs all the time. But young people, they want their hamburgers, they want their donuts, their Mexican food. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. This new generation is embracing a wide variety of cuisine.
If I were to be somewhere along on Warren Avenue in Dearborn at 3 a.m, what would be the most striking thing I would experience?
In Ramadan, it's like the city has flipped that you would see. I think the biggest thing for me is seeing so many young people out. I don't mean just like teenagers, but we're talking about like 8-9-year-old kids with their parents. Some people in Dearborn are more conservative, and so they have, you know, stricter rules about when kids can go up. In Ramadan, the rules get relaxed a little bit. And so for me, the biggest shock was you go to New Yasmin at, I don't know, 2 a.m., you'll see like 6-year-old kids with their parents. And that's a really wonderful, beautiful thing.
You're building community.
Exactly. You're building community. You're finding people. And I think especially right now, just given what's happening in the world, community is so important. And Dearborn is a place where people can kind of, every time I go there, I kind of just relax a little bit. Not to sort of over-exotify it. There are problems. There are issues of class issues. Some people are on food stamps there. Mm-hmm. So there are problems in Dearborn. I don't want to deny that. But Ramadan is a time where people sort of celebrate and come together and say, let's enjoy this month. Whether or not you're Muslim or not, whether or not you fast or not, no one's going to ask you that question. Just enjoy the good food and smile and enjoy.
What would be a greeting, you know, is there a Ramadan equivalent of Merry Christmas?
Yes, there is. It's Ramadan Mubarak. So Mubarak means greetings. So you just say Ramadan Mubarak. And you can actually say that for 30 days. And then on the last day, it's pretty easy. You just switch it to Eid Mubarak. So Ramadan Mubarak to everybody.
Zahir John Muhammad is an MFA student in fiction at the University of Michigan, and he co-hosts the podcast Racist Sandwich, so check that out. His story on Dearborn during Ramadan is in Our Detroit magazine. Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you so much.
And Stateside's ongoing series Beyond the Coney highlights the growers, entrepreneurs, and culinary experts behind Michigan's diverse food economy. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.